My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Do you like professional wrestling? Well, we like professional wrestling too. This week in the news, the death of Sid Udy and the lazy river of wrestling criticism, ice cold takes on All In and a preview of Bash in Berlin and NXT No Mercy. And for Vader Club this week, Orient Express versus the Rockers from Royal Rumble 1991, because I wanted to talk a little bit about Bad Company, but hey, we may talk a little bit about Sid throughout this show. Yeah, is that a Mega Man shirt, by the way?
It is. Years ago, I went to this podcast conference and I met a fellow who was doing production, and his company or his brand or whatever basically was a take on Mega Man.
Okay.
And he gave me a free shirt, and it's a great shirt. It's comfy. I wear it.
It's a fun shirt.
I know, right? Like, it's a fun shirt. I was like, oh, this is great. This is a good shirt, man. Nice job.
I was never a big fan of the Mega Man games. My brother was more of that, but they do have some nice ripoff merchandise. Like, there's a Mega Man shirt for the Flash and his villains. And his rogues gallery, like Captain Cold and Captain Boomerang and whatnot. Yeah, that's a lot. That's really, really cool. Okay.
Oh, I love Mega Man.
It's a fun game. It was just not my jam. It was my brother. So,
but yeah, the music's a killer. Absolutely. Yes. And one of the first like adaptations of like 80s heavy metal and shred metal into a soundtrack. Mega Man 2 is basically nothing but Iron Maiden ripoffs.
Really?
Yeah. The Iron Maiden gallop is all throughout. The
like the thing for like Run to the Hills and whatnot.
Exactly. That run. The composer, his name eludes me right now, sort of referenced that he had been listening to heavy metal a lot. But yes, very clearly, the Run to the Hills gallop is there. Most notably on Dr. Wily's theme, the first level of Dr. Wily's theme, or Dr. Wily's stage, has that gallop in on the bass line real heavily. But there's other places where it occurs too. And then like on the X series, you really start getting like the harmonized guitar solos. It's a very, very Iron Maiden heavy metal inspired soundtrack. Storm Eagle, a true banger of
my
a number.
My mind is blown right now. Also, a coworker's kid is really getting into Iron Maiden right now. It's like, okay, cool. interesting choice, but okay. starting off, Sid Udy, a.k.a. Sid Vicious, a.k.a. Sid Justice, a.k.a. just plain Sid, master and ruler of the world. Passing away this week of cancer, his son posting on social media. Some say it's brain cancer at the age of 63. Our buddy on Voices, Rich Kraich, I won't say it's clickbait. It's behind the paywall, but the headline got a lot of hubbub because he called him the best bad wrestler in the world. And I'm not going to deny that there's some truth to that statement. I think Sid is very misunderstood. Sid, of course, coming into wrestling at the time when it was still a very carny and do as little as you need to kind of business. He was a man who did business and was difficult about doing business. Let's put it that way. He was 6'9", and his greatest crime was getting his main run when work rate seemed to be all the rage in the early to mid 90s in terms of his big money run in the WWF, and then later WCW. But I mean, watching matches, he could do a kip up. He was 6'9" and could do a kip up. How would I characterize for nobody who knows anything about the behind the scenes things of Sid? The height and kind of attitude of Kevin Nash combined with the Ultimate Warrior's screw you, I'll walk away if I have to type of a thing, along with a little bit of Vader's thinks he's a tough guy, but he's not really that tough type of a thing. I mean, infamously got into fights with Brian Pillman and Arn Anderson. Did he stab Arn Anderson or did Arn Anderson stab him?
I thought it was he stabbed Arn Anderson. Which is kind of where the Psycho Sid thing came from.
That's right, Psycho Sid. I forgot to put that down on here. Okay, yes, as his nicknames. I was thinking about them. Yeah, Sid's thing is he'd always get pushed heavy, and then right at the moment he was supposed to get the title, things would just implode somewhere, although he did get the title once in WWF. And
oh,
in WCW.
Several times in WWF.
Yeah, well, see, this is where my lapsed fandom kind of goes.
Yeah, he won the title two or three times in the 90s there. Like, they're not long runs because Sid would get the softball bug.
Yes. Hold on, let me explain this. For those of you who don't know, Sid in Tennessee, much like Jerry Lawler, because Jerry Lawler never trained. Jerry Lawler's exercise outside of professional wrestling was softball. And actually, it's rumored that Jerry Lawler is the one who also ratted out Sid, that Sid was skipping dates, among other things, to go play softball, etc. But yes, Sid loved in the summer playing fairly competitive recreational softball. And so he would no-show dates, or he'd say, I'm taking time off, and he would go play. And occasionally he'd get injured in these games too, which would then lead to him not doing wrestling bookings. But please continue.
Yeah, he's, you know, the analogy or the comparison that I kind of came up with is he's almost like a Shaquille O'Neal-like figure in his career, where his size always allowed him to put in less effort than everyone else around him. And he never was completely in after like kind of that initial run. Shaq was the first couple of years very dialed into basketball. After that, his interest would peak and wane throughout the rest of his career. And it was never, there are definitely times where you could fairly say that basketball wasn't a priority item for Shaquille O'Neal. It was a thing that he was doing. And Sid, it feels like professional wrestling was the same thing. There are definitely times in his career where it seems like Sid Udy enjoyed, got more stimulation, was more happy playing softball than he was being a professional wrestler. And I think that lack of passion, especially for some fans and some reviewers and people who have chosen like make their whole life writing about wrestling or covering wrestling or watching wrestling or whatever it is, Seeing that lack of passion, I think, sort of
angered them.
Yeah, it's jarring. It angers you.
Yeah,
like,
it's like,
how could you be just sort of half-assing this? You could
look at Chris Benoit over there. He loves his wrestling.
Right. And you could be totally passionate about this, Mr. Sid. And if you were, like, we've seen
they talk about him like the C student who should be getting A's if he worked harder.
Yes. And I think if he worked harder, this is the C plus student who could be getting B's and B pluses, but he was never going to be an A student.
I agree. I think there's always been a problem with belting a guy like Sid, because Sid is great in the chase. He is great as a monster. He is a great as somebody who you want to see destroy
people. He's
great in the mix. He's great as a heavy. But once you tell him, yeah, you got to do 35-minute matches, and you have to sell a bit, then it becomes a problem because you don't want to destroy his aura either. So it's always like, and this is why I never liked Nash as a champion either. Because
it's to me, part of the problem with The Undertaker as a champion,
yes.
Because The Undertaker, much better worker. I want to make it really clear here. Chris is not comparing Sid and The Undertaker now.
And The Undertaker also had the additional thing of having a gimmick that he was not from the dead.
Pain resistant.
Yes.
Yeah, right. No, these just to me make for very limited options in terms of this. It's like, all right, you're going to put Bret Hart in the ring against The Undertaker or Sid. What does the sharpshooter spot look like when we're sitting here and having the meeting and planning this out? These are the things you have to think about. Like, yeah, Michaels can hit the sweet chin music on both these guys. And, you know, you can have that kind of like, oh, man, he got him. But anytime, like, you know, Ken Shamrock's going to put the ankle lock on The Undertaker, what does that look like? You know, what does it look like when Ric Flair breaks down Sid and puts the figure four on him? How does that work? I mean, these or The Undertaker. Flair's got the figure four on The Undertaker. What does that look like? I think these are always tricky cul-de-sacs with the, you know, the big hulking monster finally winning the belt.
Sid, my time period or my fandom of Sid is that early Crockett to WCW through kind of the Ric Flair Royal Rumble where Hogan pulls him out kind of a thing. But I'm early in there where he's coming in with the Skyscrapers with a returning Dan Spivey. And he just, if you want to see how big of a deal this was, because this is very early on, put on my comfort pay-per-view, Great American Bash 1989. Watch the reaction to him in that double ring battle royal, and then watch the crowd and listen to the crowd, because this is a Baltimore crowd, heelish type of crowd in the late 80s. They're put in there against Shane Douglas and Johnny Ace, the dynamic dudes, who everybody effing hated, because they were the little surfer guys that they were trying to push as, oh, the girls love them and the kids. Yeah, they came out, Chris.
They had MSK energy.
It was worse than MSK energy because they didn't believe it. And they came out to the worst song of that time period, the Fat Boys and Beach Boys version of Wipeout.
Oh,
if you've ever heard that.
Oh, that was a piece of shit.
Oh, that was horrible.
But
was
the Mike Love controlled Beach Boys is so bad.
No, it was the Kokomo era.
Yes.
The Beach Boys. Yes. But it's like every parent and every adult loved it because it's like, oh, it's hip hop, so I can relate to my kids, but it's also the crappy pop of my youth version of the Beach Boys. It was like the worst of both worlds. But anyways. Danny Spivey works the majority of the beginning of this match, and this crowd just doesn't care. They're just chanting for Sid. We want Sid. And Sid comes in there and just absolutely bodies both Johnny Hayes and Shane Douglas, and this crowd erupts.
I mean, he has a number of those entrances. The Madison Square Garden, anytime he's in New York,
yes,
it seems like he is just electric. And for me, one of my first wrestling memories beyond sitting in Andrew Slezinski's basement and watching WCW Saturday Night, seeing the Laughing Man, Hugh Morris, and Ming wrestle, I don't even know who, in the squash matches, was going to Blockbuster and renting WWF pay-per-views. And one of the first ones I rented is the one where Sid comes in to Madison Square Garden and he is just fist bumping everyone on the way
in.
Yes,
I remember that one.
That crowd is ravenous for him. They feel like he feels almost like a cult leader, and these are like members of his cult completely embracing the pure manic charisma of this guy as he's walking to the ring. And he had this awesome for the time theme song. It's a nice composition. The drums and stuff have aged poorly when I went back and listened to it this week, but like actually all the stuff that's going on there, the strings are really cool and creepy. I love all the harmonic moves there. And Sid just exudes this menace and this charisma. And when he stands up in front of that sparkler with the zigzaggy Sids, and he does that thing, he looks like a god, dude. He looks like a main eventer. Yes. He looks as main event as any wrestler I've ever seen
He's
in my life.
He's always looked main event, and that was his strength, really, even in the early when they brought him into the Horsemen. When the Horsemen was then, it was Flair, Arn, Barry, who's a big dude, and then Sid, who looks ridiculous in a tuxedo, but still, they literally only brings him in to fight RoboCop in 1990. But I mean, everybody remembers like the power bomb on Pillman in the War Games, where he ends up like almost breaking his neck. But really, for Sid, the thing that got him into God status were squash matches. If you wonder why guys like Wardlow and guys like Hobbs aren't as big as they as big guys back then, they tried to, the last guy they really, really, really tried doing this heavy with was Ryback, and it worked.
It worked, right. Right. But Ryback also had charisma. He had that, had that, like, somewhat.
He actually has Sid charisma, when you think about it.
He was like a watered-down Sid charisma, right? Yes. That's exactly it. No, like, Ryback in The Secret, the fact that he actually read all the way through that book. Because that book is basically written to keep you just turning the page, and The Secret is, and it's almost what it is it's Sesame Street's "There's a Monster in This Book," only for adults.
Yes.
Like, you just turn the page all the way to the end and you can get the answer.
Shout out to the Shake Them Ropes theater character of French existentialist Ryback.
It's the entrance. It's the squash matches, and then this is the other thing.
He never acted like a heel either. Let me just, before you get to your last point here, because I don't want to lose this one. He was playing to the crowd in the late 80s when he came out, almost like a babyface in Crockett. And you're like, you need to stop that, because Luger would kind of do the same thing early in his career, but Sid didn't care. Sid gave no Fs about babyface heel dynamics, because the crowd loved him. So he was there to be the gladiator and to destroy. Like, go watch Lee Scott squashes versus Sid. Sid Vicious kills his brother and then asks for two more matches because he looked so good against him. Yeah, you know, I sent you that one with one where he throws him over the rope and then throws him back in.
This is one of these things that ends up holding him in unbelievably good stead going into the 90s, because Sid had completely rejected the 80s Hogan Dusty era babyface heel construction. Not necessarily through a refined academic intellectualized concept of I am going to have a charismatic connection with the audience.
Or even through a swarmy Kevin Nash style, I'm going to be Scott Hall, I'm going to be
subversive.
Clever.
Yes. And sabotaging. It was never, when Sid was doing it, it was not meant to be subversive or sabotaging in that sort of passive aggressive way.
Right.
Sid just viewed his job as go out there and be electric. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But right. You know, like if people are yelling at you, that's good.
Yes.
And if people are quiet, that means they don't give a shit, and that's bad.
Yes.
So right. Like I mean, it's a very simple construction, and what it yields is a different relationship with babyface and heel dynamic. And it's watching some of his stuff when he became Psycho Sid, and they wanted, especially against Michaels, to have him presented as a heel, and he's really just sort of doing his own thing and sort of naturally pushing against it. It makes for a really interesting dynamic for Michaels to be working into. Jim Ross is having to work overtime to be like, yes. I would ask Sid if he would, maybe if he was a coward when he did this, to be like, I am not a coward. I'm scared of nobody.
Yeah. Jim Ross is trying to do, when he jumps to WWF finally, Jim Ross is trying to do narrative, the same kind of narrative stuff where it's like, this is the story we want to tell. And Sid has no interest in telling this story right now. Sid's just going to go out there and be Sid. And he's going to be angry. You know, hey, Sid, be angry. Okay, be angry. I'm growling.
And of course, he has no concept of what JR is saying, too. So, like, when JR is saying, I'd ask Sid if he was a coward when he hit the 61-year-old man with the camera, and Sid's like, I tremble before no man. Everyone
the
is
ruler of the world. You know what he's doing? He's doing his version of Shakespeare. I am the master and ruler of the world, and Jim Ross is trying to like make it relatable to somebody.
But you know, here's the thing: I am the master and the ruler of the world is a great tagline.
Yes,
it's seemingly,
especially for Sid, a guy that looks like Sid.
Yes, right, a guy who looks like Sid seems to be laboring under some level of delusion and not quite amongst us, but no one can actually challenge that delusion because he's so big. Like, he is the master of reality, because if you challenge reality around him, he smack you and you go spinny spin and then maybe over the top ropes.
Like, late stage Sid, like the Goldberg thing with the car.
Why me?
That's his version of Tennessee Williams right there. He's just Stella. But I remember what I'm looking at, like the squash matches I sent you, and I'm just thinking about that one where he's teaming with Stan Hansen and just being one of those two dudes and going, this is just a bad day at the office. I came into work and I'm going to work a squash match. Let's see. Who am I up? Sid. Okay. Who's the other guy? Stan Hansen, who can't see and is just right, yeah, punching dudes in the face.
You can be like, Stan, slow down. He'll be like, okay, all right, I'm sorry.
And then
the next clothesline's just going to waylay you. It doesn't matter. It might be worse.
No, tag in Sid. I'll take his clothesline. Just give that one to me, please. And then the greatness to me of Sid is then, you know, like he became kind of a free spirit there in the mid-90s. And he has that short run in ECW, and Lance Storm has the greatest description of it, where it's like Sid would show up in his shirt and jeans, take off his shirt, put on his neoprene elbow brace, go out there, powerbomb somebody, come back, put on his shirt, and leave. I'm here for these guys. I'm here for this.
He was the Attitude Era before the Attitude Era.
Yes.
There's actually a promo that I'm watching where he comes to the ring and his Psycho Sid theme is on the entire time. He is doing an interview with Vince McMahon, and Vince is actually kind of setting up the stage for Sid, because Sid's the champion at this point.
Yeah.
And Steve Austin has an attitude. Bret Hart has an attitude. Shawn Michaels has an attitude. And Sid,
does he have growly voice on?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, like all these people have attitudes, and you know, Sid is in there, and I was watching Sid and thinking about, and it's kind of struck by, Sid is perfectly consistent with where this company vibe wise would be going over the next 3 years. He didn't ultimately fit in with that for all sorts of various reasons. But the tone of the Psycho Sid championship run is basically the Steve Austin, I don't care if I'm a babyface or a heel, I will hit anyone with the powerbomb, I'll hit anyone with the stunner. You know, good guys and bad guys. I mean, let's not forget, Steve Austin at one point was hitting women with the stunner. Yes. But he didn't give a care. And Sid is in the ring, and he is doing the other thing that he does that I think works for him is the loud soft thing. He actually goes up and down in terms of tone and dynamic in his voice in a way that I think draws you in, and he's aware that when he comes down in his voice that it draws people's ear in that much more. He even says it actually in that promo too.
My great what if, because I was such a huge fan going into Starrcade 89, and he's teaming with Spivey, although I still wish I had once gotten to see Sid and Mark Callis team, because they bring in Mark Callis eventually when Sid decides to go away for a while, a.k.a. The Undertaker, as part of the Skyscrapers. But leading into Future Shock, it was going to be a round robin between the Road Warriors, the Steiners, Doom, and the Skyscrapers. And then on a house show in Norfolk, Scott Steiner, who did not care about anybody or anything, ends up doing this move that punctures Sid Vicious's lung. So the Skyscrapers are on there, replaced by a Samoan team, which was more disappointing because I loved the Skyscrapers so much. But him as a horseman was perfect for me. And then, you know, the Hogan stuff, I mean, WWF knew how to use him, don't get me wrong, but he was like a man outside of time, because it was all gearing towards, you know, the chattering Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, both of whom he had pretty good matches with, but still, I mean, he's a giant in a land where the guys with the power are pushing for good matches type thing, and he's still kind of a throwback.
They could have belted him against Hogan too, but they weren't ready to give up on Hogan yet.
Yes.
But he is definitely one of those moments where you can begin to feel the crowd having decided Hogan fatigue.
Oh, the 92 Rumble is that moment when he pulls out when he pulls out Sid while he's standing on the ground, and then it's like, and then they decide to run that angle where Jack Tunney goes, "Nah, we agree that was valid." And you're like, what?
I mean, this, in a way, that moment right there is sort of the prelude. It's not like the start of the Attitude Era, but in a lot of ways, that is as emblematic of where wrestling was going and as much of an inflection point as anything. You have Sid, a guy who had been actively sort of eschewing the 80s construction of babyface and heel, and at that point had an organic connection with the audience, and Hulk Hogan, perhaps the most quintessential definition of babyface versus heel in the 80s, and the audience was over Hogan, and they wanted the WWF presentation to move to a more nuanced adult. Gray area sort of presentation where Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Steve Austin, Owen
Flair
Hart.
Even. I would throw Flair in there too.
And Shamrock, Ric Flair. I mean, any number of these guys later on would be sort of never, you know, not pure babyface. Like, I love the fans. Or
not,
like,
not
I,
an 8-year-old's cartoon series type
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly. And Sid very much was the forebearer of that. I mean, we mentioned this before, but I do think it's definitely a thing to consider when assessing his career that much more. He was burdened with the exact same problem that pretty much every big guy like him post Andre the Giant had, of how do you put the belt on this guy and then have coherent and interesting matches, whether you were talking about Sid or you're talking about Goldberg or you're talking about Big Show, anyone, how do you make them have an interesting, compelling match where they, especially if you're going to have them as the babyface giant champion.
Yes.
With Andre, it worked because there was just always this sort of like, he's this big giant, but there's just this like air of a little bit of vulnerability. He's a little brittle and you can kind of feel that. But when you've got a guy like Sid or Scott Steiner or Goldberg, how do you make them sell? How do you make them show ass? How do you make them show weakness? And this is a problem that has really persisted to this day. It is a It's not something that Sid could have solved, because in the 30 years hence, it still is a problem that has not been solved.
I mean, you have it in the women's division too. Like, how do you have somebody like Jade Cargill show ass, but still maintain their tough, you know, credibility type of thing? They've kind of solved it with Nia Jax a little bit, but they've made Nia Jax clumsy. That's how they did that there. But yeah, it's you're right. It's been an issue for at least 25, 30 years.
Yeah, ever since Andre, where it was like he was so big that you could credibly sell that his size was in fact an impediment.
Yeah,
you know,
and the other problem.
It kind of take him a minute to get up and stuff, because when you're that big, you can't do anything fast. And that like is something you could work with narratively.
Yeah, and the other issue was, of course, WWE fell in love with. Yeah, their giants were 6'9", but the average worker was like 6'5", 6'4". So you really had no giants in there also. So yeah. We might do Vader Club with Sid next week if you so choose.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, no,
I will
get us some Vader matches. I am so down. Some Sid matches. I'm so down. Or Sid and Vader matches.
Well,
that is
the big Sid Vader match we never got.
I know.
Because remember, that was when Ric Flair had to be put in there for you know, the retirement versus title match type thing, and he wasn't sure he could go because Sid, that was when Sid stabbed Arn, and it was supposed to be Sid versus Vader at that pay-per-view.
Right,
yeah.
And I think they were going to turn Vader face at that point against Sid.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think...
Because they also had Sid
versus... I remember
versus...
that build-up. I watched that like several years ago, but I think... The tease is that Vader was getting like in his squash match and stuff, was just trying to have like competitive, like, you know, beat the crap out of people stuff, and he was getting kind of fed up with Sid.
And I think that was also dependent on where Rick Rude was going to fit in, because he originally had a Sid versus Rude feud penciled.
That's
in
right.
There too.
They were gonna turn Rude. They wanted, yeah. There was a real thought of turning Rude, because he was really over as well.
Mm-hmm. When he didn't have the stash. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. McMahon, a documentary series chronicling the rise and fall of the WWE's controversial founder, is coming to Netflix on September 25th from Chris Smith, executive producer of Tiger King, and Bill Simmons. This is a postscript from our friends at WrestleNomics at Post Wrestling. Neither Janelle Grant nor her representatives were interviewed for the Mr. McMahon Netflix documentary, spokesperson for Grant tells WrestleNomics at Post Wrestling. This is Bill Simmons. Bill Simmons loves his WWE access. I think this is gonna toe the line, but it's never gonna go in hard against him. It's gonna be, you know,
this is gonna be controlled opposition. This is a controlled opposition piece.
Yes.
In a way, I sort of view this as Netflix doing some damage mitigation, that it's better to be in control of the authoritative, no holds barred documentary on Vince McMahon than to have it be out of your hands and have it be something that's even deeper and more damning.
And even more direct A to B. Raw is coming to Netflix.
Right. Right. That's
you can't have a documentary where you go, hey, look at this scumbag of this product that we're gonna try and plug.
But you also can't ignore the Vince McMahon thing. So it gives them the plausible deniability.
Yes.
What this reminds me a lot of, this is going to be a weird reference, but like it's just the thing that came to mind when I was like hearing this story earlier today, prepping for the show. This reminds me a lot of what the producers of Star Trek did with Star Trek Picard. Which is kind of the unsuccessful, not well-liked attempt to get Patrick Stewart and everyone back into the mix for three seasons. In season two, where they started making this thing called the Ready Room, where they'd have Will Wheaton talk to people on the show, and Wheaton would be the proxy for the fan who's a little bit skeptical, and sort of be the control, the opposition, just asking a little bit of softball-y questions so that they could cut him down. And even in feeling what they thought was the overarching critique of the show that the fans were giving, that it was too socially conscious or whatever, that wasn't actually the main critique, and they were focusing in on that critique, because the main critique that was coming from people across the social spectrum, if you will, was that the show didn't make any sense and was poorly written, and they didn't want to address that criticism.
It was just fan service.
Right. Right, and it was long and sprawling and inconsistent and meandering. The episodes weren't really episodes. And that is, frankly, a much more damning critique to deal with. So they chose to go after this critique. And this is what I was thinking with Netflix and this WWE documentary. Oh, they'll bring up some stuff. Maybe it'll be about the Owen injury. You know, maybe they'll bring
the
up
Montreal screw job,
stuff about dirty dealings with contracts and, you know, doing
how
some
he
people
screwed
blah.
Over all the promoters that his father was friends with.
Absolutely.
You know?
Right. Like stuff that's been out there, but it'll avoid talking about sexual assault and Vince McMahon in any meaningful way. Or doing what I think would actually be the most interesting thing to do with McMahon, now that we know so much about him, a forensic analysis, and this would be amazing to do for Netflix now that they have access to the whole catalog, a forensic analysis of the Raws that correspond to key weeks where Vince McMahon was allegedly doing sexual misconducts and things.
Yes.
To see how those segments and things, if there are perhaps Freudian things that are dribbling onto our television set. Not that Vince McMahon would ever do anything like that.
Your talk about Picard reminds me how much my dad was disappointed by that show, mostly because it's like, I just want to see O'Brien. Want the engineer back.
Right. No, it was really bad. I mean, there's a whole bunch. Don't get me started on that show. It does horrible things with the characterizations of everybody that make no sense in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
But going back to Vince's pathologies being played out on TV, the one that I always point to for those who've listened to the show before is the time that Vince trotted out Titus O'Neil on the 1,147th episode of Raw as like the global goodwill ambassador or whatever, because he got in hot water for something racial.
Yes, and after and that was after suspending him for touching him.
Right.
Yeah, I remember that. That was just that was stupid. Some contract re-signings that aren't there very important. We'll skip them because we have a lot to do on the lazy river of wrestling criticism where we watch where we had time for, and there was a ton of it. All In this past Sunday, both Chris and I watched it. So ice cold thoughts that we might tie in with Dynamite, because you'd think that after their big WrestleMania that this Dynamite would be big, and instead it's just, God, we got to plan for another pay-per-view in 10 days. Which stunk. Look, the Bryan Danielson swerve match was fantastic, I thought. I really didn't like the way they put Hangman in there, though. I mean,
they used him exactly how I said they were going to use him.
Yes, they did. No, you're correct on that. My thing is, AEW has this problem now that WWE used to have, where it's like, we need to set up the next feud at the big pay-per-view, when they don't. They just need to finish the feud and then set it up on their television the next week. And they did it throughout here. I liked MJF versus Ospreay quite a bit. And the rest was perfectly cromulent, although I liked Tony Storm and Mariah May should have been reversed based on the titles, but I understand why it was there. But that Mercedes versus Britt match wasn't very good until the end.
I have seen takes that have said things like the division has passed Britt Baker by, and I would submit that Britt Baker was not the only problem in that match.
I will say I think Britt just needed a couple more warm-up matches before there. And I think if
Mercedes hadn't had the match with Sheeta, I would be more willing to lay more blame at Britt Baker's doorstep. But
okay.
Mercedes was a problem in that match with Sheeta as well.
Okay, I think Mercedes did as well as she could. I put a little bit more. I mean, I'm not a worker though, so this all sounds stupid, but I do think Britt thinks she's a great worker and she's a good worker. I'll put it that way. It wasn't a bad match. I mean, it wasn't a horrible match in terms of that, but it was, it had high expectations and it didn't meet them. Let's put it that way.
No, I completely agree. I thought that it was one of the more underperforming matches on the show.
The one that got me was this Casino Gauntlet, which has now been turned into their version of Money in the Bank, apparently, because I just didn't understand the booking. Yes, they went top heavy. Yes, it was star and star and star. But it's also one of those things where it drew focus time after time because it kept trying to top itself. And I was thinking, you know, Nigel McGuinness coming back for the first time in a decade and a half is enough. It is enough for that match to draw on that. Ricochet debuting is enough. You only need one. And then you add in, like, Zack Sabre Jr. getting the British pop, and I get that, you know, he won the G1, and that's good for New Japan fans. Not so big on my fandom, big on other people's fandoms. And then to have all these guys, and to have Okada, and to have other main event guys in here, and then Christian wins. That just felt underwhelming to me.
So all of those other things would have been absolutely fine for a Christian victory, except for the Nigel McGuinness one. The second you have Nigel re-debut in the Casino Battle Royale, I think he has to win the, you know, the chip or the briefcase. He has to win. That has to be the freight train that is coming Bryan Danielson's way. I think it's the match with the most intrigue. Now, don't get me wrong. I can see a story that can be told with Christian that can be very entertaining about fathers, especially now with Danielson leaning so much into being a family man and everything like that, and Christian being the bad dad and the leader of the patriarchy and everything like that. But it is not particularly intriguing as a Chekhov's gun to the end of Danielson's title reign. I think in a way it would be good and very Christian-like for him to be ultimately the one who retires Bryan Danielson so he could lord that over all of us for an indefinite amount of time. But on the other hand, I think that it should have been Nigel. Nigel has established his pure contemptuous hatred of Danielson, that Nigel should be assembling like his little goon squad of, led by Christian as like his bad lieutenant, of people who want to kill Bryan Danielson, the league of guys who don't like Bryan Danielson, and they should be making Danielson's life hell in service of Nigel.
I've thought of, and this will get into Dynamite discussion a little bit, which is fine, because I think, you know, it was a good card. It was a good card. All In was good. I wouldn't call it a great card, but it was mostly good. I have this scenario, though, Chris, where they're just going to piss a lot of people off, and I think they want to piss a lot of people off based on the fact that Jack Perry is going to be facing Danielson at All Out in Chicago, and they did that expressly to try and draw a little bit of heat, I think, from the CM Punk fandoms in Chicago, which it doesn't exist anymore because AEW fans wanted to get rid of CM Punk. But there's a scenario I have in my head.
Well, except the problem is that AEW still needs wrestling fans to come to AEW yes. shows. And CM Punk's an active wrestler and people seem to like him right now.
Yes. But my scenario is this. Christian cashes in, gets revenge on Jack Perry, pins him for the title, and then Bryan Danielson is retired after screaming, "I'm not ready to retire yet. I'm not done yet." And then he's just kind of looking around going, "Well, I guess I'm retired now." Just to take the wind out of all these dream matches that everybody has in their head.
I mean, this is the one problem with like the victory lap, final lap title run here is that if they don't advertise that this is Bryan Danielson's last match and really give away the ending of that match, they're idiots. They're not going to yes. draw as much at that show.
They're trying to get the Wolf tickets like the Flair retirement thing. Like the next time you lose, you're done full time.
Yeah.
I just, I don't get that.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
What did you think of Swerve and Hangman on Wednesday?
I'm checked out on Swerve because I don't know what Swerve's about. His defining trait, the most consistent thing about the man, is that he likes to go after people's families.
Yes. Okay.
That
good.
Is the one thing that is the most consistent about the guy.
So,
and I think that that makes him kind of like repulsive on a natural level.
Let me lay this out, because a lot of people really loved this promo, and I kind of went, no, I'm a little confused by it. And let me explain my methodology of this. So, three nights earlier in London, Hangman comes down, distracts Swerve, that then gives Danielson the upper hand in their title match. It's not a screw job, but it's not exactly a clean win. And Swerve is so angry that he comes down and he enters the ring and he decides to monologue. And then in the course of this monologue, he's getting under Hangman's skin, and it's fine, because Hangman's still kind of the heel, and they're still kind of doing the Who's House, Swerve's House thing. And then all of a sudden, Swerve decides to drop the little tidbit that, oh, by the way, I stopped by your house again and stalked your family again. Was this a double turn? I don't know. But here's the thing I do know. Once is an accident, twice is a coincidence, three times is a pattern.
Right. This is a defining character trait. A defining character trait about this man on multiple occasions with multiple people is that he is perfectly willing to stalk people's families.
He's a scumbag.
He's a scumbag.
He's a hardcore street guy who's a champ, who's also a babyface. I was baffled by this, because
he's a babyface when it's rhetorically convenient for him, but he's actually a piece of shit guy. And like that, to me, if you're getting into what is Swerve's character, that is the character. It's like, oh no, I'm a hero of the people, like, you know, rob somebody's wallet, you know.
That needs to be his nickname. Piece of ass Swerve Strickland. No, and that's a terrible nickname too, but it's like, he needs to go back a third time and have Hangman beat his ass, right?
And it bothered me too that Hangman didn't just beat the crap out of Nana, because holding on to him, you are having rage issues with your fellow competitors in the ring.
No,
you should murder this guy.
Not just that, he has rage issues. And then he becomes the emo cowboy again. It's like, what kind of man are you going to be in that cage match? And he runs away because he's so angry that he can't control himself. I just went, I was confused by that segment. It's not that it wasn't rhetorically good. It was rhetorically inconsistent again. And
the tail end of stuff. I mean, this is, it kind of is a similar analysis to my Gauntlet match analysis. If you analyze the tail end of it in a vacuum, absent everything else that preceded it, okay, like the part where Swerve is basically breaking down Adam Page's motivations and breaking down the anger into vulnerability and showing that the anger is a secondary emotion, that would be good. But for the fact that Swerve proceeded to do that by saying, I stalk your family, your wife is fair game.
That's the guy we want to build our company around.
Oh, hell yeah. I love this guy. I want my kids to look up to him.
Nana's dancing. Hey, we're stalking the family.
Whose house? Your house.
Whose
fam? Your fam. Like,
whose house? Your house. A few times without you ever knowing it. I'm the baby
night,
face.
I like to watch your children sleep.
Your wife was very, very pregnant. Why are you looking at my wife, dude? What's your problem? I came out of that going, all right, sure.
cool. He's the guy in the he's the soldier in the movie who's trying to make the case to his other soldiers that civilians are now fair game.
We must burn this village to save the village. Or was it like casualties of
take
war?
Take them out. What about the women and children, sir? I said take them out.
Yes.
All of them.
All of them. Ooh, ooh, and this is the music where he becomes the bad guy.
Yeah, zooms in on Swerve's eyes, and there's that evil sparkle.
And yes, but in the reflection, it's the burning village. You know, it's, oh, see, he ordered that because that's
you can
what
hear
he
the
did right
yeah, you can hear the screaming
every,
and
yes,
stuff.
It's
yeah,
that every Vietnam movie where the squad leader's the bad guy, and they have to take out the villagers, and it's like, oh, look at him, he's a bad guy. We shouldn't like him.
Our commanding officer, man, he's losing it, man.
Stephen Lang in what's that dumb blue alien movie that they're making 20 Avatar. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. Not much else in AEW world I want to comment on other than I liked the end of Hangman Ishii. It just went like two segments too long. Ricochet, how is he now a big star when you have him doing like a 40-60 match and you announce him, this is his debut? Okay, great.
he is firmly right in the middle of things now.
He's 40-60 against a 6'4" guy who's also athletic and can move around and doesn't matter. So it's like you put him against a guy like Commander or Mortis, I'm cool with. Oh, and speaking of which, that they did some good things on there, but they were baffling. Like Takeshita, that video package made him look awesome. And, oh, he's coming back. It's going to be hard. And when am I going to get to see him? Am I going to get to see him on Dynamite? Nope. You can watch him on Rampage in a four-way against two luchadors who don't matter and Leo Rush.
Let's circle back to Ricochet, though, real quickly, because okay. I think the debut of Ricochet or re-debuting Ricochet for this company
sucked.
And presentation issues. No, it does suck. And here's kind of a alternative model of how you would debut a premier Will Ospreay, Ricochet, premier high-flying athlete. You have him go up against your other mid-card guys. I feel like we always pick on Commander, but the commanders of the world in this company. And lo, there are many, and you can even get people below Commander too. And what you do is you have them get into a match, do the initial, like they do a series of arm drags and flippy do things, and then they both end up high, you know, standing and they're like, ah, and everyone claps because they went mirror. And then after that, Ricochet like absolutely wipes him out. The guy goes for his next move and Ricochet's a step ahead. Guy's down. He goes for like the next move, like a moonsault up the top. Ricochet hits him with a drop kick as he's coming off of it and gets just a pin. That like these aren't even things where Ricochet's busting out the 630 or anything. It's essentially a cruiserweight squash.
Yeah.
Where this guy is too fast. He is like in this genre of fast, high-flying people in this arena, he is a step faster than these other guys who you've seen do cool shit before. And he's just, like, way faster.
Some guys weird member of Private Party or something. Just have him just murder death him, and it's not going to hurt Private Party as a team because they're doing comedy skits with Okada. I mean,
these can be high-flying squashes, like the Logan Paul spot where Ricochet
hits Logan.
You basically have things like that, only now Ricochet is doing that to people, and he is just cutting off these high-flying guys.
You make him a star.
The question, who could possibly keep up with this guy?
Yes.
And then you have Ospreay doing the same stuff on the other side.
Because you've built up intrigue on Ricochet and who can keep up with him. And, oh, the handcuffs are off of him now. Because that's the theme they're going with is that the WWE run, that was Ricochet with handcuffs on. Now the handcuffs are off and he's going to be friggin' awesome. And we're just going to give you a taste here. And now on commentary, we're going to put over, oh my God, who can possibly do all this stuff with him? And then unfortunately what you do then is you have Pac come out and do that awesome poison run on Will.
Right. Ricochet's in the ring having a match, not against dollar store Will Ospreay, but rather Trader Joe's Will Ospreay in Kyle Fletcher, where he's going 40-60.
Yeah.
And what kind of build, like, to your point, you have Pack whooping that ass on Ospreay at the top of the ramp, and then Ricochet and Fletcher are completely winded and exhausted at the end of this match. It might just be that they were gassed, but also visually speaking, doesn't make me super excited for when Ricochet finally meets Will Ospreay, because he just barely got by Kyle Fletcher here. Fletcher was hanging in there for a good long chunk of it. We know Ospreay's way better. We just saw him beat MJF.
Let's move on to our previews, because we got a couple of those. We got some stuff to get through. On Raw this week, best thing on there was that Bronson Reed, Braun Strowman thing.
I love everything about Bronson Reed right now.
He's great with that.
Yeah. Man, his characterization's awesome. When he went up to The Miz and he explained his motivations for everything and how he sees it, made perfect sense. Like, you can absolutely understand how Bronson Reed sees it that way. And he's basically like, anytime someone is getting murdered by me, it is because they have chosen to put themselves in front of my path. And when you make that choice, and I'm very transparent about this, I will make you pay for that if I have the capacity to do so. The same way Braun Breaker does, same way other people do. I just take no prisoners should you choose to get in my way. And, you know, this makes it very interesting. And if you want to turn Bronson Reed at some point, you know, he's always got that case to make where he never beat up anybody who didn't step in his path.
5-match card, one of these specials for foreign lands that just, it always kills because the crowd's going to be hot and they don't overstay their welcome. Learn from
this. The matches get the time necessary to breathe, and the performers know that there will be increased focus on their match, and they are attentive and aware of that focus. It elevates the performances.
4 of the 5 are intriguing. This one might be a little rough in places, but it's the unholy union of Alba Fire and Isla Dawn, probably with Blair Davenport hanging around somewhere, because that's what the build's been all about, versus Bianca Belair and Jade Cargo, probably with Naomi hanging somewhere all about, for the tag team, for the WWE Women's Tag Team Championships. Alba Fire is, of course, fantastic. There will be no slander of her on this, and Bianca's fantastic, and Isla is good. She's not bad.
No, right? You used to beat up on her.
That's because her gimmick on NXT UK.
But no, I think she's a very solid worker, and her and Alba Fire have, I still just think she should be Kaylee Ray, but like her.
Same.
And yeah. I'm broader note, since we're not going to like dwell on NXT, I'm so over the NXT name generator where every single person's name has the same like rhythm.
Cadence. Yes.
Yes. It's ba ba ba. It's Baba Booey is basically the rhythm of everybody's name on this show right now.
Yeah, we'll get a little NXT in here in a bit. But Bianca and Jade are winning these tag titles, right? Because everything's been about Blair Davenport screwing them for so long.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
it's time, though. It's time to try out what you have.
I mean, didn't they did that already, though, didn't they? They already had her. They already had them as tag champs.
They did, but remember, they did the three-way, and that way they didn't have to actually pin them.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I can see them keeping it. I just don't see.
You could. You know what? This might be the time to do the second run and then the split. So
yes, that's what I'm thinking.
Maybe so.
And finally get Jade Cargill to be the heel that she should be. It's not that she's a bad babyface. It's that everything about her screams heel.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, increasingly I feel that way about Joe Hendry too.
Yes. Well, your take is different though on that one. The contrarian take is correct in some ways, but at the same time, it's like, oh, that's just Chris being cranky. CM Punk versus Drew McIntyre in a strap match. Hell yes. Hell yes. Hell to the yes.
It's going to be great. I think it's going to be great. But when we get to Joe Hendry, I am now going to talk about him exclusively while playing the chords from Oasis's Wonderwall so that you can understand what I hate so much about this. All of my commentary will be done over Wonderwall.
Who do you have winning between CM Punk and Drew?
I think this feud continues. I think Drew wins.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. I'm good with that. I'm there because it has to go to something. Like, but how do we heighten this? Are we going to get to a retirement match eventually? I don't know.
That, I mean, that could be – like, the stakes need to be raised. I think this goes to Hell in a Cell, though.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah. This is Hell in a Cell situation.
It's fall, so it's getting close to that time, yeah. The Terror Twins of Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley taking on the Judgment Day of Dirty Dominic Mysterio and Liv Morgan in a mixed tag match. I am also of the opinion that this feud continues. So
I think so too.
I think the Terror Twins gets. I am not blown away by Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley.
They just don't have charisma together, neither as platonic friends nor as romantic intrigue. They
haven't figured out a reason why these two are hanging out with each other.
Right. Okay. So here's the thing. Like, beyond having shared enemies, they need to have shared interests.
Yes.
Like, Rhea needs to just be like watching an old 80s horror movie. And Damian comes in and is like, oh shit, is that They Live? I love Roddy Piper in that. And they both say, you know, the Roddy Piper line. Like, they need to actually have shared interests. They like the same bands. They like the same movies.
They're still battling each other over who's going to lead the Judgment Day, even though neither are in the Judgment Day anymore. They're both alphas that they can't, you know, they can't really figure out how to get over their alphaness in their scenes.
And I just think, like, oh, I'll wear your t-shirt if you wear mine is weird and, yes, power sherry, right?
Yeah.
It's like creepy. And like, I just think I'd rather see them both wearing the same type of band's t-shirt. You know what I mean? Like, let's say one's wearing a Social Distortion t-shirt and the other one's wearing a Descendants t-shirt. Or one's wearing, you know, you pick your metal bands and that sort of thing.
Cody Rhodes versus Kevin Owens for the Undisputed WWE title. I think they've done as well as they could on SmackDown building this. The A-Town Down Under have been sowing seeds of dissension between the two by showing, hey, look, Kevin Owens actually turns on a lot of people. They did an entire video thing of him turning on Sammy and turning on Kofi and turning on everybody he ever did. And Kevin's excuse was, oh, I turn on scumbags. And then it's like, well, except for Kofi. It's like, well, Sammy really didn't do anything wrong, but I guess they're destined to fight
Sammy
forever.
Sammy went through an inexplicable identity crisis with the Bloodline that still has not actually been intellectually accounted for.
Okay.
Like, what the hell was he thinking when he joined the Bloodline?
I think this gets a little bit of chicanery with some Bloodline stuff in it again. I think Cody Rhodes wins this.
I think Cody, you know, beats Kevin Owens here. I don't think Owens turns heel in any meaningful way. I think we get some teases of that. I think, if anything, we are building to the dissolution of A-Town Down, that the focus on Kevin Owens is the red herring, and instead we are going to get Grayson Waller going more heel.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I was thinking maybe there's a scenario here where Roman makes a save against people, and then it's like, well, Kevin Owens take advantage of this type of a thing and gets very overbooked, but I think it's going to be more A-Town Down. It's going to be more those two geeks.
It's more about A-Town Down. And I do think that there's an interesting further point of dissension between Owens and Rhodes about what is the dynamic with Roman Reigns that is acceptable.
And that's what I was looking at.
Cody is doing, I think, a stupid thing, you know, just broadly speaking of, okay, 4 months ago, like within the same calendar year, Roman Reigns and his uncle or his cousin, The Rock, were beating the crap out of Cody Rhodes and making him bleed and had a belt that said Mama Rhodes. And now all of a sudden, Cody has decided that Roman might actually deserve some strange new respect. And Kevin Owens is much less like much more consistent, at least with my understanding of reality, where he's a little slower to forgive that level of being awful, that like somebody actually has to do some work to come back. And Owens will probably be making the case to Cody that Roman has not made the work to come back here, that Roman's interested in handling his family business, but is not actually repentant for any of the torment that he's caused to either one of us, that he's just using it. Like, I see that as the future piece of friction between Owens and Rhodes. So I don't think Owens can turn on Cody at this point. I think that Owens loses, but he doesn't turn.
Right.
Him.
And then for the World Heavyweight Championship, Gunther versus Randy Orton. If Orton wins, he's transferred to Raw. If Gunther, and Gunther gets transferred to SmackDown. The best thing about this feud is Randy Orton knowing he's going to be in a world for hurt against Gunther's chops and him kind of like acknowledging that in every promo. I'm here for this match. I think this match is going to be fantastic. And I think
Randy Orton being bitter that it took crowds 15 years to fully warm up to him when he went out there and in an era when people were demanding work rate and he knew it, stubbornly refused to deliver work rate on
a headlock, baby.
Yes. And made fun of it and made fun of it. He's the guy who came up with dive. Right? Like, he is the guy who said that initially, like, as, yes, like, a little joke, right? Like, he was the, not like Sid, where he didn't work because, like, Sid just wasn't going to do that because he didn't need to. Randy, like, knew that he could, absolutely had the capacity to, knew that people wanted him to, and then didn't deliver that. And it like, the Daniel Bryan matches and stuff. So he's, like, you know, needling people.
I
and, like,
know
you
what
know.
The fans want, and I have no interest in giving it to them.
Yes, yeah, right. It's not even, it's the kids who are wrong. It's like, no, the kids are right. I just hate children. That was Randy Orton for 10 years.
F them so, kids. Yeah.
F them kids. Like, I know, though, it's not that the kids are wrong. I just effing hate them. So when Randy's out there going, oh, it took 15 years for you guys to start singing my song, I couldn't help but think, dude, they would have sang it way faster if you had in any way given them what they had wanted between 2010 and 2013. And you have to know that in your heart of hearts. But no, obviously Randy loses here. As much as we were all excited for the transfer of Gunther to Raw, I think Gunther's going to have to stay on SmackDown. Randy's going to have to stay on
Gunther
Raw.
Gunther to SmackDown.
Well, yes, as that is what I meant.
Yes. No, I got you. And then the next day, because it's a long holiday weekend and WWE needs to demand all of your free time, NXT No Mercy from Denver, Colorado. Interesting card, an interesting go home. I so enjoyed, number one, Rosemary is fantastic. I love her. And I hope she gets a contract with money in it from somebody. If there's a talent sharing exchange and NXT and WWE is kind of, you know, giving a little bit extra in the till, I hope she gets all of it because I love her. She just gives her body to every match. I've seen her break it in front of 100 people. And she is what the spooky dames want to be.
Oh, yeah. No, I think Rosemary is the inheritor in a lot of ways. And I think she'd probably be flattered by this comparison, or at least I'd hope so, to, like, Daphne.
Yes.
And that she does it so, so well. It was really nice to see her on NXT. I thought, frankly, she ran circles around Kalani Jordan.
She did. Again. She
yeah.
did. That was good for Kalani too.
No, it's good to see. It's good. I think Kalani actually, especially because I think there is some truth to this whole, I've always been really successful. I've always been, yes, you know, like I'm a super, I think that's a true gimmick and they're presenting it as a babyface thing. But I think that people like that live in a myopic bubble. A bubble where people are like, you're great, because especially around all of them, they are the rock star. And I think Kalani Jordan very much benefited, from this situation here.
I think there's a little Britt Baker in that truthfulness too. But we'll go to the matches. Roxanne Perez versus Jada Parker for the NXT Women's title. That slap was fantastic. It was. It really was. I don't think got Jada Parker over for me, but I don't think she wins the title here.
No. I thought that the slap on Jada was excellent, or by Jada was excellent. I thought that was a nice contrast. Jada needed to differentiate her story from the other people. Like when Roxanne came in And I think this is sometimes an issue with some of these promos where it's like someone comes in and throws down a gauntlet and it's on the other person to return fire on that.
Yes.
And Roxanne came in and said, "You are just like all the others who have come to me. All the, I'm just happy to be here. Smiley faces, even like Thea Hale or whatever." And Thea, you know, turned it up a little bit, but Jada gave it that much more. She's like, no, I just don't respect you at all. I don't actually care about your accomplishments.
And then Chekhov's debut is going to happen after this match. Whoever the woman was in there, be it Julia, be it Stephanie Vaquer, or be it the other girl that they signed that I can't remember her name right now, it's going to be her. So
I mean, I think that was the one, you know, unfair thing to Jada Parker.
Yes,
going into her match.
Everybody's more interested in that than this.
Right. And like, we know that Jada's not winning on this limited of a build in the same way we knew that Thea Hale wasn't winning on this limited of a build. But at least you didn't already know who is facing Roxanne next.
Kehlani Jordan versus Wendy Chu for the NXT Women's North American Championship. A lot of spooky stuff. But I think Kehlani still wins. I like Wendy Chu, but I don't like this character.
I like this character. I think Kehlani's going to win. I think they need to do a serious reassessment of her character following this feud.
You want the heel turn. Just say it. I want the Kehlani
Jordan
heel turn.
Dude, no, like, yes. This doesn't work. And frankly, I like her baby face. No, it's more than that, though. I do find her personality sort of, like, naturally heelish. But beyond that, her baby face match style is super stale. It's the same cartwheely gymnastic bullcrap that I've seen for years now. It's not interesting. It doesn't look hard hitting.
She has been taught to the test. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Like, and she needs to learn how to do something other than that stuff and how to work in the gymnastics and the athleticism into something better.
Oba Femi versus Tony D'Angelo for the NXT North American title. I wonder who's going to call this match. Probably Tony. I like the vignette. I don't love the vignette. Like, they're both charismatic in their own way, and they're both their own character, but they're not real. They're kind of ships passing in the night.
Yes. No, that was it. This is the other promo that I was thinking of on NXT when I was talking about, like, throwing down a gauntlet and then responding to that gauntlet. Like, a lot of times people come out and give a promo, and then their response to that promo, Wesley and Zach Wentz was the same thing, where Wesley's like, "I'm on another level than you." And Zach Wentz had nothing to say to it. You know, he was just like, "You're a bad guy. You hurt my feelings. I loved you." And Wesley's like, "I'm on another level." Same thing with Tony D'Angelo and Oba Femi here, where D'Angelo is saying to Oba Femi, "You started this," and Oba Femi's being obtuse about this.
Yes.
And it doesn't make any sense because, like, he knew what he was doing.
Oba Femi is literally doing, "I'm the master and ruler of this restaurant." Tony D'Angelo's like, "I'm trying to talk to you and you're not listening to me."
Right. Like, you won't even give me the basic respect on this. And then meanwhile, the Thugs are in the ring having a dumb tag match with the mini mafia, and I'm so over the main mafia and the mini mafia mafying every week.
In what seems like a feud that's been happening for years but has only been a few weeks, Andre Chase and Ridge Holland of Chase University versus Nathan Frazier and Axiom for the NXT tag titles. Are we finally breaking up Nathan Frazier and Axiom?
No. I think they're winning. I think they're winning this
they're
back.
Winning the titles back. Oh, God.
Yes, because I think Ridge Holland's been laying this shit on really thick.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a flash title reign for Ridge to finally turn heel.
So this is a story about the breakup of Chase University.
That's what
than,
I think.
Okay.
Like, I think this is about Ridge Holland finally showing his true colors.
Fair enough.
Yeah, because it's always been there. And like what he's doing, I've been baffled by the performance. But my only thing I can come up with is that this is a flash towel reign. The whole "I'm going to do this till the day I die" is a preface and a presage for them dumping the titles here like within a couple of weeks.
Wes Lee versus Zachary Wentz in a singles match. Going to be a banger, and then Wes Lee's going to screw him.
Oh, yeah. If Zach Wentz wins this, it's idiotic. I hated this promo. I mean, obviously, yes. I think Zach Wentz has a punchable face. I hated his neon suspender crap. I'm really pissed off, and I wore my Nickelodeon neon green suspenders to tell you how pissed off I am. I want to cover you in slime, Buster. Come on, dude. Just a t-shirt and a pair of effing jeans.
It's for the you can't do that on television title.
Yes. Yes. Like, what would you do, called? And they want their outfit back. Double Dare and Mark Summers want you to come back to the set immediately.
Summer Sanders doing backstage promo.
Yeah. So Wes Lee, meanwhile, in addition to that, like Wes Lee coming out dressed like a normal human being, and then Wes Lee delivers a promo to Zach Wentz that has the damning benefit of being true, where he's telling Zach Wentz, "You stink. You screw things up for us. And then after you screwed things up for us and me, I had to pick up the pieces. And you know what I did? I picked up the pieces. And you know what I did? I went to another level. And you're not on that level. You're on another level that is beneath me." And Zach Wentz, at that point, upon getting the rhetorical slap across his face, was burdened with looking at Wes Lee and screaming at him, "No, I've always been on your level. Not just behind the scenes where I've been carrying your ass, but inside the ring. I'm a step faster. I've always been the one with the plans going into the matches. When we've won, it's because we've been following my game." Like, he needs to have an entire cogent case to Wes Lee that he's actually been the one who's always been carrying Wesley's ass, and that he screwed up, he owns screwing up, and Wes Lee needs to let that go, because that's not anything. And instead we zoom back in to a man dressed like he's about to appear on 1993 Nickelodeon, and I'm gonna love him as 7-year-old Chris.
And then finally, the man who looks more like a champion than anybody right now, including Cody Rhodes, because Cody Rhodes still has the neck tat, Ethan Page.
Oh, he's great. He looks like a champion.
God, he looks like a champion. Versus Chris Novembrino's favorite wrestler, Joe Hendry, for the NXT title, with Trick Williams serving as the special guest referee.
And Pete Dunne hiding in the shadows.
Yeah, I'm somewhat confused, because, boy, this feels like Trick Williams just turning heel on Joe Hendry and going, "We're NXT guys. You're TNA guys. We don't like you."
No, but no. What's going to happen here is Pete Dunne is going to do something to F with Trick Williams.
And then they're just going to lift the arm. One,
that's
two, gonna, three.
That's going to result. Yeah, that's going to result in Trick Williams counting the victory for Ethan Page and not seeing something that screws over Joe Hendry.
Or he's knocked out or something. Joe Hendry will lose.
Yeah, Joe Hendry is going to get screwed, and Pete Dunne's going to kind of aid in that screwing, but like Paige and Dunne are not going to be in cahoots.
I am going to be very interested to see Joe Hendry's reaction in Denver outside of the confines of Florida.
I am too.
Let's see if this act has any legs outside of the general TNA Performance Center area.
Yeah, it's going to be a real interesting heat check, and they need to start coming up with other stuff for Joe Hendry to do.
Oh, I think this is his swan song. I think he's done.
Oh, I know, but I mean, when he decides to come back around here again, because there's
unless WWE has bought his contract and they're going to debut him on the main roster.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's maybe that he disappears for a little bit and then he comes back around here. And there's a lot here to like. I mean, he has a natural charisma. There's no denying that. I think you gotta decide on the characterization thing. And him coming out here and playing the beginner 5 chords that you learn when you learn guitar, the first like 6 weeks of guitar, and thinking that that level of competency or lack thereof is enough to merit having a concert. And then not only when you do this concert with the douchebag headset. He doesn't even use a mic like a normal human, Jeff. He uses the douchebag headset. Like this is the pep talker headset. Like everything about this guy is sort of naturally heelish. And then I just don't think the material was there with this song.
Yeah.
The song to me wasn't funny. I think it, you know, in terms of characterizing Ethan Page, we have never talked about him as the action figures guy. So I don't really,
why would you kill his aura when he's the most old school 80s type, wearing a suit and bringing the belt champ and saying, oh, he plays with toys. Why would you do that?
I don't get that either. I really don't.
It's for people who have watched TNA and remember him as Karate Man over there. And it's like, people don't remember that anymore because you're in the WWE universe where more people actually watch the show. Like 6X viewers of TNA's weekly show watch NXT.
Yeah. Ethan Page is his own character at this point. And then, like, Ethan take off his or put on some clothes. Again, that's... It's weird to say that when it's not like Ethan Page himself is prancing around there.
Yes.
It's you who's showing me the picture. So, like, it's weird to be like, man, this guy should put on some clothes. Isn't this weird? Hey, Jeff, look at my phone. Look at my phone. This guy should put on some clothes. Isn't that weird? Like it's you who's making me go there right now. It's not actually that guy.
Go ahead on to Vader Club. It was my week to pick. And I'm going to wax a little nostalgic for a few minutes about a team that I love but never really got to reach their potential, in my opinion. That's Bad Company, the team of Paul Diamond and Pat Tanaka. Both guys were kind of preliminary dudes in their respective areas. Pat Tanaka, early in Jim Crockett, where I remember him from. And then Paul Diamond was originally a soccer goalie at Old Dominion University, went into wrestling, went down to Texas for a while, an all-star, teamed with a guy by the name of Shawn Michaels. Both find themselves about 2 years into their career in Memphis, Tennessee, where they end up teaming with each other and becoming pretty good tag team specialists. They're fighting guys like the Nasty Boys early in their career, fighting Jeff Jarrett and Billy Joe Travis and Tracy Smothers and other guys like that. Then they have a decision to make after about a year or two of being in the Memphis territory, where they were managed by both Brickhouse Brown and Downtown Bruno. They can go to the NWA back in Pat Tanaka's stomping grounds, or they go to the AWA, and they choose to go to the Minnesota territory, where they become BADD Company and teamed with a very young but hungry manager by the name of one Diamond Dallas Page, who towers over both of them because he's not a wrestler at this point. He's just kind of a shill here as part of the Diamond Exchange, and they become the AWA World Tag Team Champions, fighting guys like the Olympians and a nice little feud with a team of Shawn Michaels, Paul Diamond's old tag team partner, and Marty Jannetty, a.k.a. the Midnight Rockers, over there. And then then they kind of split them up. Tanaka goes with Akio Sato, who Chris knows better as the guy who managed Hakushi during his time in WWE, and become the Orient Express. Diamond remains in the AWA for a time, teaming with guys like DJ Peterson and whatnot. And then all of a sudden, Akio Sato decides he no longer wants to be a full-time wrestler, but he wants to work in the WWE office, helping with Japanese engagement, which has always seemed to be the goal, but they never quite get there. So what can we do? Oh, well, we'll bring in Paul Diamond and put him under a mask and call him Kato. And that is how this version of the Orient Express comes in. They do some matches here and there. Eventually, Pat Tanaka decides he wants to go to other things. He becomes part of Smoky Mountain in that USWA feud for a bit. Does some prelim work for Dusty down in WCW because he still likes him. Paul Diamond, of course, becomes Max Moon after Conan decides he no longer wants the gimmick. And then they kind of go on and they become prelim guys for ECW during the Eastern Championship Wrestling and the early Extreme Championship Wrestling. They feud with Public Enemy and the Bruise Brothers down there. They get brought in for like enhancement matches, because Bischoff still likes him as both El Gato and also as Sensei Tanaka. And Paul Diamond brings his gear, and they do this great angle with Arn Anderson where you expect Tully Blanchard to come in and get the save. But of course, Tully Blanchard gets lowballed at Slamboree once again, never goes in there. But the problem with Bad Company is they don't have a signature match per se, because they're in the era of television wrestling where it's squashes and screw jobs, and the great matches are in house shows. And those don't necessarily make it to tape because the AWA is not a rich territory, so they don't film those necessarily. There are plenty of good matches that you get to see on the tapings with them, with like the Rock and Roll RPMs and the High Flyers and the Top Guns and et cetera, et cetera. And of course, they had magical chemistry with Michaels and Jannetty. And so when we want to get the Rockers over, what do? We team them with Diamond and Tanaka at the opening match of Royal Rumble 91. Did you get a chance to watch this, Chris?
No, I didn't, Jeff. Okay. And unfortunately, I kind of got to get rolling here. And
okay,
like,
cool. Yeah. I will continue. I'll end the show for you if you need
to. Yeah, please.
Okay.
No, if you want to continue reviewing it, for sure. But no, I have to. I've got a lesson here in a few. So.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. I'll just say a quick few words. It shows what Tanaka could do, because he has the best flying forearm and he has great thrust kicks. Diamond's kind of the power guy. They have great double teams and stuff. You see the shades of Bad Company. You can watch a lot of their stuff on YouTube, including promos and stuff, which aren't good. They were never good promo guys, but they're one of those tag teams that are always what if for me. What if they had come to NWA and been in that Fantastics mix? They got to face the Rock and Roll Express a little bit in AWA, but this is when the Rock and Roll Express was kind of washed. So yeah, but I highly recommend the opening match of Royal Rumble 1991. Orient Express versus the Rockers. It's a fantastic match. It goes on a little long, but it's a fantastic match. And since Chris needs to go, I'll wrap this up. We will figure out something for Vader Club, probably Sid related this week, and I'll let you know.
Yeah, no, I watched a ton of Sid matches. We'll talk about them more next week here. My name is Chris Novembrino. Please follow me on Spotify. I make the musics. I also teach guitar lessons. Follow me on Instagram, DOCTOR_NOV.
You can follow me at CrapGame13. You can follow the show at Shake Them Ropes. I'm also on Fight Game Media on Wednesdays doing the Dynamite Show with Paul Fontaine about 20 minutes after, and that drops in your feeds the next day. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Bye.
Hey, kids, do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling, too. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Myself and Chris Novembrino kind of doing a lazy river of wrestling criticism, going through the news and whatever happened in stateside television wrestling. And also, you know what? Sometimes we just like to watch old stuff and talk about that, too. Love for you to give us a listen if you haven't already. We are Shake Them Ropes here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network.